Thank you, Howie. Thank you for asking me to give this talk on Higgs physics at E plus and minus colliders. So I'll discuss the Higgs physics at electron positron machines, proposed FCCEE, CEPC, and ILC and CLIC. So let me first just go just briefly introduce these machines. So this is from a recent workshop on the FCC. So FCC is proposed to be a 80 to 100 kilometer circumference tunnel, where you perhaps would start out with an E plus and minus collider, which would operate between 90 and 400 GeV. And then at some point later, you would install the hardware for a PP machine that could perhaps go up to 100 TeV, and there's also the option of electron or proton machine as well. This was the potential strategy for CERN, where perhaps even before this, you have not only the HL LHC, but also perhaps a high energy upgrade of the LHC. To be followed by at some point once there's sufficient funds to build a 80 to 100 kilometer tunnel, and you'd have the FCCE with 90 to 380 GeV. So this is an outline of a program that could run 60 years or more of E plus and minus and proton physics at the highest energies. In China, they're considering a similar procedure, but with a ring that's maybe 50 to 70 kilometers in circumference. Again, you would build the tunnel and start with a E plus E minus machine. With a 50 kilometer tunnel, you probably would have a limit of 250 GeV to the center mass energy. But again, you would run for a certain period with the E plus E minus machine, and then install the hardware for the proton machine. And so this is a similar proposal to the one being considered at CERN.
The booster 54, there's a booster, so there's a low energy, medium energy, high energy booster, and then there's a 54 kilometer booster.
Yes.
Yeah, I know that would be
right.
No, I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't understand either.
So it's continuous top up, right? So there's an accelerating ring and a colliding ring.
Okay. But an electron.
Okay. It's for the electron. Right?
It's for the. Yeah. Yes, it's for the electron.
Like another ring that's parallel to the collider ring.
Yes, I'm sorry. I can't say anything about that. I'm sorry.
Four interaction points.
Well, they discuss really two interaction points in the physics study. It's assumed that there would be two interaction points.
Two for each machine, it looks like.
Yes.
And there's a candidate site outside Beijing is one example on near the coast, and then there's also being discussed now a site near close to Hong Kong. Two different sites being considered. For linear colliders, there's the ILC, which is currently being seriously considered by the Japanese government. That's a machine which is 30 kilometers in length. The nominal center mass energy is 500 GeV. There's a TDR with a description of a energy upgrade to 1 TeV, which involves a combination of a gradient increase and additional acceleration. That's why it shows here 50 kilometers length instead of 31. And then there's at CERN, they're studying the CLIC, the warm RF two-beam acceleration of which can bring the center mass energy because of the higher gradient to up to 3 TeV, and they consider energies from 350 GeV to 3 TeV. I won't have specific. I won't be mentioning Click very much after this, but that's really doesn't mean that the studies that I show had major contributions from Click physicists, and they've been in the past 3 years especially. They played a major role in studying the physics, the Higgs physics at not only higher energies but also 350 and 500 GeV. So I'll mention ILC, but the Click people have played a big role as well. Shows the ILC machine parameters from the TDR from several years ago. So there's a baseline machine, a luminosity upgrade in the TDR for 500 GeV, and also a center mass upgrade as well. So the luminosity upgrade involves installing extra klystrons and modulators, so the number of bunches can be doubled. And in the running scenario, it's envisioned that this would take place about 8 years after baseline running. The energy upgrade is more expensive. It involves increasing the accelerating gradient and lengthening the LINAC or both. And the TDR assumes a 50-kilometer length. And because of the expense, in the running scenarios, this is not foreseen until after 20 years or so. However, obviously, once you get the thing built, this energy upgrade is always going to be a possibility once you've built the lower energy machine and you have sufficient real estate.
So in the early days, they used to talk about building the machine at the longer length but having fewer magnets and then filling it up to get to 1,000. Is that now off the table?
Yeah, the tunnel will be dug only for 500 GeV. If later you want to upgrade to 1 TeV, you would. And actually, what you mentioned was also until a couple of years ago was thought how you would start the machine at 250 GeV. You build the tunnel for 500 GeV and only install the hardware for 250 GeV. But that's no longer the case. It's felt it's overall, but for two reasons. One, it's less. It's more efficient to build the whole machine, a 500 GeV machine, mm-hmm. than to stage it that way. And also, frankly, with the development of the circular machines at 250 and 350 GeV, it was felt it was a good idea to emphasize sort of the more unique capabilities of ILC, where it has higher energy. So that it's now. The official line is that you build it from 500 GeV at the start, and the running scenarios makes that assumption, and it's had a big impact on how we think that the machine would be run.
So then, if the machine were built, it would actually start at 500.
500 GeV, yes. At 500, yes. You build everything at 500 GeV before you start running at 250. Uh-huh. And there was also the issue that at the ILC you need to run. Not just at 250, but also at least at 350 to get the WW fusion physics, to get a complete Higgs profile. So there was always a pressure to go above 250 GeV. Not in the TDR, but done a few months after the TDR was published, there was. Work done on a luminosity upgrade, not just for 500 GeV, but also for 250 GeV, where you quadruple the luminosity by doubling the number of bunches and the collision rep rate. The initial the tenderness operation, which is in the baseline, was split between a five hertz collision operation and 5 hertz E plus production. And that, in the upgrade, goes to 100% collision because in the upgrade it's thought that there will be a longer undulator that would be ready, that can produce enough positrons with 125 GeV electrons, so you don't have to split the collision rate between positron production and luminosity. Just note that the AC power is 200 megawatts, which at this 250 GeV upgrade, which is the same as the power at the 5 hertz luminosity upgrade at 500 GeV. And that's 3 times 7^34 luminosity, but 200 megawatts of power. And then I mentioned this running scenario where you, so this is our, this is now the ILC official running scenario, where you first start out at 500 GV and accumulate 500 inverse femtobarns at 500 GV. You're doing Higgs physics, but you're also exploring anything that might have been missed at the LHC that happens to have happens to be in that energy range. Then you then you go back for a small run at 350 GeV for Higgs physics as well as top physics, and then a 500 inverse femtobarn run at 250 GeV. And then install the hardware for the luminosity upgrade, and then you run and accumulate this luminosity at 500 GeV at 250 GeV. And that's the what we call the H20 scenario.
What is the motivation for the
250? We've tried examples where you only run it. I mean, you can do your Higgs times ratcheting ratios in both the Nunu Higgs in both the WW fusion and the Higgs drawing process at 500 GeV. But the cross section for the Higgs drawing is much larger, 250 GV, and it turns out that the optimum thing is to run at both 500 and 250 GV. You get the optimum Higgs coupling results that way. And that's actually, I'll talk about that later. It turns out to also be true if you assume that you also have a circular collider running at the same time as well. You benefit from both 500 GV and 250 GV operation.
Sorry, can you translate the units for the peak luminosity?
Let's see, what is that? Why this is written this way? This was done for. I'm sorry. Afterwards, I can look at this and explain it. But right in the middle of this right now, I can't explain what this is.
I think what's happening in this table is that you ramp up the luminosity in those 3-point-some years, right? And then in the first part of it, your peak is 0.1 times 700, isn't it? What's happening?
Right. So this would be.
So this would be the fourth column, 1.0, is what the.
This would be
the last segment.
Yeah. Oh yeah. A is year here. Okay. Yeah. So peak luminosity per year. That's right. So that's. Yeah. This was a running scenario table, and yes, this would be the peak luminosity integrated per year maximum. Yeah. And the ramp up assumptions shown here. Okay, so now let's move on to the comparing the differential luminosities of the machines that have been mentioned. These are the numbers from the CEPC TDR. These are the older numbers from FCCEE. I'll show the new numbers in a second. This is the ILC baseline. And then the ILC upgrade, and then this is the luminosity curve for CLIC. And then there are newer numbers for FCCEE. Shown here in red are the new baseline numbers with two IPs, and then the numbers with four IPs shown here in the dashed. In the dash magenta, so the old FCC numbers, the old baseline numbers are shown here, and then the newer baseline numbers are shown here. So the numbers with the old numbers with four IPs sort of split the difference between these two here. I want to mention one thing about lower energy running, although it's not really the subject of this. It's not really going to be covered in this talk, but just want to mention that it's not easy to run the ILC at these lower energies. A higher energy beam is needed for the positron production, at least in the baseline positron production design. With the Lumi upgrade config running at 10 hertz, it's felt that one could get these luminosities shown here, so that one gets 100 inverse femtobarns, 91 GeV in 10 months, and 200 inverse femtobarns at 160 GeV. But clearly, for this low energy running, the circular machines are really the way you want to go, and you'd only want to run the ILC at these lower energies if the circular machines were not built. So I'll just give a quick overview of the Higgs physics at different center mass energies at E plus E minus machines. At 250 GeV, one of the most important measurements is the Z Higgs cross section measured with the recoil technique, where you measure the four momenta of the leptons from the Z decay, and then using the beam energy knowledge, calculate the Higgs mass, and then you get this peak shown here for the muon channel and for the electron channel. And it's a very model independent measurement of the Z Higgs. I mean, there are people who study the systematic errors in terms of where there might be some model dependence, and but generally that's it's the model dependence is kept to a very small level. And this shows numbers here for the ILC to certain luminosity. You'll see numbers later for the circular machines, which give much better numbers than this. And you also measure the branching ratios. You don't really do it by the lepton recoil method, which can provide a really model-independent way of measuring the Higgs decays, but because of the limited statistics of the lepton decay of the Z, you really use all Z decays, QQ and nu nu, to measure sigma times branching ratio for Higgs into PV bar, CC bar, glu glu, and other modes. And then there's the same technique is used for measuring the invisible width. That's not really too different from what's being done.
Sorry, maybe it's today. A trivial question. So you were talking on the previous slide about using the Z and nu decay. What happens if the Higgs is decaying to neutrinos? Say it goes WW or something like that. You wouldn't use it then, right?
Right. So then you wouldn't. No. Then you wouldn't do it. You would. Then you'd use the hadronic decay of the Z, and. And that's the typical. That's, for example, measuring the invisible width. This is the signal shown in red that you see above background for zeta QQ and Higgs to nothing.
Yeah. So you wanted to say neutralino, not neutrinos.
Yep.
I think it
will
not be a problem. The width of the Higgs you can get by the recoil mass, right?
You get the recoil. No, the width of the Higgs comes from an analysis of all the sigma times branching ratios.
Why can't you do it from the recoil mass of the using the mu minus?
Because it's not. Well, I think that's you're barely. You just get the. I mean, you got a broad.
You measure the V cross section there, or decoupling to the Higgs, but then you have to combine with other measurements in order to get the width.
I thought the whole big thing about the E plus E minus, the clean collider, and we can get the width of the Higgs.
Yes, because
you do.
The width of the Higgs, but you need to combine.
You do. You combine the sigma times branching ratio measurements with the Z Higgs cross section.
You have a number for what it comes to be, the accuracy of the Higgs.
Yes. It'll be in these tables later. Yes.
So,
couldn't tell the difference between left and right.
Sorry, that left and right is the polarization of the electron polarization, and then and this sometimes it's in some applications it's better to run with left-handed because you want to increase the usually that means you increase the number of signal events, but left-handed also increases the number of background events. In this case, running with right-handed gives a better signal to background.
So the signal should be the same more or less, isn't it? And the background changes when you do this.
Well, you got to. I mean, generally, you have W-induced backgrounds here that are being suppressed by the by this right-handed polarization.
Not because it's going through a virtual view, which is
left-handed. Yeah, there's a small increase in cross section for the Higgs for this Higgs drawing process when you go to left-handed, but it's a much obviously much bigger reduction in the background. There's also sort of there's an attitude. There's also kind of an attitude that this applies also to the. This also applies to the branching ratio measurements as well. There are many cases where you can suppress the background greatly by going to right-handed electrons. But it does reduce the signal, and there's kind of been an attitude that's developed that's kind of you should be clever enough to take advantage of the full statistics of left-handed electrons and not have to resort to using right-handed electrons to suppress your background. There's kind of an attitude that if we should try as much as we can to use left-handed electrons because that's where the signal is the biggest, but and only if there's if only at a last as a last resort you resort to using right-handed electrons.
The set coupling is pretty simple, right?
The coupling?
The set coupling of right-handed on.
Yeah, it's similar. Yeah, it's similar. But not exactly the same. And it's so slightly the cross section is slightly higher for maybe 10. I forget what it is. It's slightly higher for left-handed electrons. Yes. And because statistics is so important, you would like to be able to use those even that small advantage from the statistics. And so it's felt that one should only use right-handed electrons to suppress background as a last resort.
Are the positrons polarized?
What
did you say? Whether the positrons are polarized?
Yeah, I mean there's a TDR spec of 30%
on the next slide.
Yeah, 30%. But it relies on this undulator positron production method working. So at 350 GeV, all the Higgs-Strong studies that were done can also be done with comparable precision. You're not that far away from the peak, so there's still a good amount of ZH production. But then at 350 GeV, the WW fusion provides a much better measurement of the W coupling than you can get at 250 GeV. And this then provides a much improved estimate of the Higgs width, which improves all the coupling. So everything, it's the last final piece you need to bring everything together to get all the to turn signal time branching ratio measurements into coupling measurements and to get out the total width. At 350 GeV, the Higgs recoil mass measurement is significantly worse. At 350 GeV with respect to 250 GeV. However, there are studies that indicate that a direct calorimeter measurement of the Higgs mass can compensate for that.
But this GHWW measurement requires, or at some level, it's limited if the Higgs has an invisible width.
No, it's independent. No, what you're doing here is you're measuring basically the sigma times branching ratio of the WW fusion to Higgs followed by Higgs to BB bar.
Okay.
And then that stigmatized branch ratio is then added to all the stuff that you measured at 250 GV. And you know, you just go through and you'll see that everything that's the last
thing. You sort of get the total production rate from the ZH process.
Yeah.
And then you get it one stigmatized branching from here.
Yeah. It's sufficient to just completely determine everything, including the total width.
Can you ask something that's just maybe stupid, but can you get anything by scanning around 250? Because there must be some behavior that is proportional to both the Higgs mass and the Higgs width around 250, because the message is the just go to 2mh, that's what comes out when you try to find the maximum. So did anybody talk about scanning? Just like we did
well, that? I mean, the last time people talked about scanning was to determine the spin of the Higgs, but that's now has been determined. See, we haven't talked about that for quite a while, but you're referring to using that method to determine.
There are some parameters, but including the Higgs.
But you do know the mass, right? So that would be the parameter you could measure when you actually scan.
I still didn't get how you measure the width, so this is probably why.
So you start off by measuring the coupling GHV, okay?
Yeah.
And then you measure production cross section times branch ratio. And you do this for a couple of channels, and you can extract the total width out of the combination of those channels.
So normally when you see it in a specific final state, you see sigmatized branching ratio, and so you're not sure about the numerator widths because of the denominator width. But if you can see the Higgs independently of its decay mode in recoil, so you build the Z spectrum and you look to see that there's a Higgs recoiling against it kinematically, independent of the decay mode, that's how you break the degeneracy that you have at the LHC. You
can't. So the recoil is your second measurement, sort of?
So I would say it's measuring the total production cross section through this recoil technique. And that's completely different from what you do at the LHC or in most of the other measurements.
Yeah, this is not stigmatized branching ratio. It's a measurement of this cross section, V Higgs. It's just unique to E plus E minus, and it's just the key to all these model independent. Coupling measurements as well as the total width. I mean, yeah.
Okay.
You have all these stigmatized branching ratios measurements, and then with Higgs drawing and with the WW fusion, and you combine that with the cross section measurement, and then everything falls out. Okay, then this WW fusion process is just as good at 500 GV or better than at 350 GV. So at 500 GV, you get a bunch of measurements of this type here, at very good accuracy. And then also through TT bar Higgs, you get a direct measurement of the top Yukawa coupling, which is 17% at if you run at 500 GV, but there's a strong motivation to run at 550 GV because there's the cross section is changing very quickly, and so you get a much reduced error if you happen to not use the round number of 500 GV, but 550 GV, and certainly the ILC machine people are well aware of this number here and the motivation for it. And then the Z Higgs channel opens up at 500 GV, and with four inverse out of barns, a 27% measurement can be made, assuming that they have the true value, assuming that the actual value is the standard model value. Okay, then at 1 TV, You get better measurements of the Topi-Kalba coupling and the Higgs self-coupling. For example, at 1 TeV, you'd get 10% measurement with 400 Zatobarns at 1 TeV. You could search for additional Higgs bosons that might have been missed at the LHC, or study new resonance that might have been seen at the LHC. And in addition, at 1 TeV, the ILC becomes, or E plus minus machines become a Higgs factory again, since the total Higgs cross section is larger than the total than the cross section at 250 GeV, especially if polarized beams are used. That's shown here, the 1 TeV cross section compared to the Higgs strong cross section here. So this is a summary of
May I ask a silly question? Why does the WW fusion cross section go to zero also, or it's just a panel?
You got to see new Higgs. It should go exactly to zero at 125 GeV, but. I could blow that up and it's probably not exactly zero.
But the predicted luminosities in the circular machine are so much larger, it seems like the number of Higgs at 1 TeV, if the circular machines were built, would be much larger at the 250, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. That's right. That's the coupling of the electron to the Z is.
That's the S channel. It's an S channel process.
Why is WW so large? That's just simply the electron coupling to the Z is so small. This is with this polarization. There's a huge polarization enhancement of the W production compared to. It's small to begin with, and then there's a much bigger enhancement from the polarization.
Yes, exactly.
This is just a summary of the ILC measurement precisions at the luminosities that were used for the particular studies, these are just scaled up and down depending on what luminosity assumption is assumed. And then there's this is the summary of the model-dependent Higgs coupling precisions for the 8-year and 20-year assumptions of the running scenarios. So this then is the 3% model-independent measurement of the total Higgs width is shown here, and then 95% confidence level limit on the invisible width. For
you have a similar table for the circular.
Oh yeah, I'll get those. I'll have comparisons of them in a moment. For the And then before I get off the, before I go to the circular machine, I'll just mention the what's been the way that you would study if what's suggested by the data persists at LHC, assuming all the central value of the parameters persist and it's actually real, then this is the most promising method of producing it at a E plus E minus collider. That would be E plus or minus to gamma Higgs. This width is three orders of magnitude higher than the standard model width, and you'd get one to 100 femtobarns cross section at 1 TeV.
What is X?
X is eight. I'm just calling this. I'm just saying. What if?
X replace eight.
Oh, because they want to go above 750.
Yes, and they just take the diphoton rate.
Yeah.
How does he know the carbon? I don't understand. We don't know anything about it.
Yeah. Just assuming nominal emissions.
Okay, so
yeah,
Francois, he took existing the existing results and certain assumptions estimated that this would be the range of cross sections given this kind of enhanced gamma-gamma coupling. You could get something like 1 to 100. Femtobarnes cross section in this process. There's a small amount of gamma-gamma production at 1 TV, but and then you could also.
What do you assume about the couplings of this X? How do you imagine this produced first at the LHC and then opposite the
Zdekotov?
He's doing it through two orders of magnitude.
Sorry?
There's a two orders of magnitude guess based on 200 papers, I guess.
Come on,
that's a
matter.
It was an imaginary particle in an imaginary collider.
Okay, well, let's be okay. Let's take.
Not necessarily.
Oh, yeah,
that's what makes it.
No, don't say that.
Okay, well.
You say many. You
could. Okay, so well, that's really, yeah, I guess that's just for entertainment. So. The CPC here I list the sigma times branching ratio measurements of CPC for 5 inverse adabarns. They had a pre-CDR published a year or so ago, and they've had some updated numbers since then with some studies. So they get a 5 inverse adabarns, a 0.5% measurement of the cross section, and a variety of excellent measurements of sigma times branching ratio. Then FCC, they had I'm going to use these numbers later to compare the machines. If you assume this kind of luminosity profile for FCCE, then you get these numbers shown here for sigma times branching ratios. And at 350 GV, you'd get this number here for the important WW fusion production followed by BB bar, the Higgs BB bar. Then also there's discussions that because of the very high luminosity, there's discussions of directly producing Higgs and E plus E minus S channel Higgs production. And this is a recent study giving this kind of significance and limit on the coupling at 95% complex level. And this is an ongoing study, but a very interesting, unique capability of a very high luminosity collider. This is the major, yeah.
Using the
electron
nuclear coupling, you get 1.64 femtobarns.
Then you run the machine at 125
G. Yeah, how realistic is root S spread as gamma to gamma H? That's the big question, right? So they say challenging performance, but that's the realistic
possible. To achieve that.
And I guess if you already know the mass to 30 some MeV from something else, you only have to sort of scan in 8 chunks before you find it.
No, they do actually can measure.
Is it 30 MeV?
Oh, well,
so it's MeV.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then there've been also studies of FCCE studies now getting into the details of detector models, and here there are two different detectors shown for the measurement of the invisible.
Well, if you don't find out connected by then.
Invisible branching fractions.
I mean, some of those cross sections are beneath the neutrino floor, so it's possible. Yeah.
Okay, and then, okay. So let me now start comparing the machines. Let's first look at ILC plus and CPC separate and then combined. So what I've done is I've taken the errors from the pre-CDR and which I show again here, and then I take the ILC errors from this H20 scenarios at the baseline point and at the 20-year point, and then perform a model independent fit separately and then combine. So now this and the results that the model independent fits are consistent with what CPC sees in their gets in their CDR. So this then is a table. This is the ILC at the 8-year kind of the baseline running CPC with 500 satobarns, and down here just to get the guide the eye is which machine has the better coupling. This is the relative Higgs coupling there. And so for the CBC actually does better in all these couplings except for the WW. So here the fact that the ILC is running at the higher center mass energy is what makes a difference. So individually the CPC is better than the ILC in all these cases. However, the purple shows what happens when you combine the two, and there are the different characteristics of the machines provide an interesting complementarity, so that there's a significant, in many cases, a significant reduction in the error when you combine the two machines.
Just for comparison, how well do we know the couplings of the set to fermions?
From left?
Yeah, for instance, the set to the
You don't have the
because of asymmetries, of course.
Don't have the top there.
We're assuming here that the so CPC, we're assuming runs at 250 GeV. Cannot even access the coupling through the to the threshold measurement, and so it's left off of this. There'll be another table later, but that has the top.
Need to leave it for a second.
Yeah.
So what is the difference between this table and the other one?
Volume.
This table, oh, I'm sorry, this table, then we went to, yeah, this table then has the ILC at the 20-year running. And
full 20 years.
Full 20 years.
And how many years of CEPC?
The same, roughly 10 years. So that has not changed. I mean, after you run the CBC for 10 years, you're supposed to now go over to a Hadron machine.
The assumption is that the Chinese one will simply be there independent of the ILC.
Well,
the ILC, they will be together because normally nobody believes that there will be two electron colliders.
Well, but the CBC is more than just an electron collider. It's a proton collider as well, and also I don't know that we really understand the sign of these things. If one country, if countries stop building machines, the country there's one. It's not clear that if one country builds a machine that suppresses the desire to build a machine in another country. I don't know what the sign is.
Except for the U.S.
The U.S. is always negative. And then, okay, then one could ask, how does the CPC help the ILC in a situation where the ILC has mostly the best individual results? And the way you do that is you just ask...
But I think that's, is that a meaningful question if you think that the circular one is just a step towards that? I mean, I think the point is that the CEPC in itself is a meaningful option as a stepping stone for hadron partial law.
Right.
So the issue for this physics here is that you're not measuring above 250.
Yes.
The effect of this in those blocks.
True. Yeah, yeah. I agree that, but I agree with that. The question is, I think this is a very good plot to show why ILC is a good idea. But I think to play the role back then was, and now what do we learn after this long run? What do we have to do with the circular one? Is where you go to a much higher center of mass energy by going proton-proton. So in a way, I think it's a stepping stone.
You want to see the CPC plus SPPC figure for the
things. Exactly, that's the right question there.
I don't think that one exists.
Is that? Well, we do, I mean, we looked at this for FTC a little bit.
CPC plus S.
CPC, yeah, okay.
That doesn't, there's been no...
Yeah, no, that's minus. He's just saying it would be the fair thing to do. But there's an interesting complementarity too, because there's a few things you don't measure very well. For example, the top is not in this list here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you see here that ILC alone will do very well. All over.
Good enough.
So we did not discuss what the LHC will be able to do, right? So you add the model independence, but then on top of this, not so much.
Can you elaborate?
Because this our model assumption in our fits, right, like the ones you discussed, and we extrapolate to the outer bound, we can measure to the percent level, and here we show that the ILC can measure to the percent level.
Right. Okay. I don't, well, yeah. And of course, you and I have had this discussion of how we compare ILC results with model, with model assumptions. And I didn't include those graphs in this talk, but okay, yeah. It's interesting. How important is the model-independent feature of the electron-positron results? I don't know.
I would call it very important. So there are physics effects. There are physics effects that drop out of all branching ratios of things, right? And so if you can measure something, if you can pin one thing directly, that is qualitatively. You know, it's an incommensurable change in the physics that you can do. So I would say it's very important.
Do you have an example?
So we were talking about the Higgs quartic coupling yesterday. Okay, so this scenario where the first thing it sees in Higgs quartic is singlets, things that are not charged under the standard model, talking to the Higgs. As far as their effects in Higgs coupling go, the only things you see look like wave function normalization. So those shift everything uniformly. They drop out of all ratios of branching ratios completely. And if you have one thing that you measure independently, suddenly you can pin down that effect. So that's a whole class of things. That's basically all physics not charged under the standard model that talks to the Higgs. That's something that you can probe once you have an independent measurement of the Z Higgs cross section. So I would say that's important.
What about lambda? You said nothing about
it. Lambda.
Triple
coupling. Yeah, that's coming. I've said something on before. I mentioned it in the overview of the E plus minus Higgs physics, but I'll get to that as well. So this is again. This is trying to. Okay, I'll stop belaboring this. This is the two of them. This is just sort of highlights of what the two combined provide. For example, ILC plus CPC versus CPC. So big improvement here, and then decent improvement in these other parameters. Okay, let's not belabor that. So the Higgs self-coupling measurement, so at 240 GeV, one has access through it through radiative corrections, and I think you had this as this formula here. Oh yeah, and then you get an error of 36%. There's often an error of 30% coming from CPC, but that's a combination of CPC with 50% measurement from HLHC. But 36% is what you get from CPC alone. And of course, the trouble with this measurement is that you have a lot of, this is some conference, a lot of other examples of VSM physics that can cause a non-zero value, a value different from the standard model for the Higgs-ZZ coupling. And the ILC then here provides, a 500 GV collider provides a tree-level measurement of the Higgs triple coupling. What's done, of course, and this is also the case at LHC, you have other diagrams contributing to the double Higgs production. Not just the triple Higgs, but you have diagrams that have the ZZ Higgs coupling, and then you also have a diagram here with the quartic coupling. Assuming this is fixed to the standard model value, you get this error that I mentioned earlier. You get a 16% error on the cross section, which then translates into a 27% measurement for this 20-year scenario. I guess you may know this as well, but if, for example, the true value were to be double the standard model value, then the error would be reduced. So this is 27% relies on the fact that you're assuming the triple Higgs coupling is the standard model value.
Is there a number that's the equivalent of Matthew's number? Like if I change the Higgs coupling to ZZ and the triple Higgs coupling simultaneously?
I thought the assumption was that this coupling here we're going to get from the lower energy measurements.
Yeah, and so obviously in Matthew's case he can't independently measure these two things, but the complaint about Matthew's claim is that, well, if I have other contributions to HZZ, then that washes out any effect that I would, any contribution from changes in the external here. So he has a formula that sort of tells you the relative magnitude of the effects. So I was just curious, because it's true that we will independently measure HZZ. I'm just curious, though, because HZZ also enters in this measurement and there's interference between all these processes, is there just a number breakdown of, like,
It's not known. Yes, it's not known perfectly well. So there is a What is the what does propagate that? Well, to be honest, I guess we haven't been. We can do that, but we've been concerned more with this because we can't measure this. We can't measure this anywhere else.
Right. Okay. So, but is there now a linear combination of three things?
I have slides that. That go through.
How big is this? I just don't have an idea. How big is the quarter coupling, the tail diagram? What is the contribution of the tail diagram to the how strong is the assumption that you take this to be standard model?
In the standard model, the relative, does anyone know what the relative contribution is of this in the standard model to, say, to the triple coupling? I don't know offhand what the relative, what the size of this is.
There's nothing special about fixing this to the standard model or fixing this to the standard model.
It's not rocket science. But we have to figure this out.
But anyway, so let me. I just wanted to briefly go through. And okay, I have too many slides here that describe how we. Our current thinking about how this is handled, because you just can't measure this anywhere else. So what do you do about it? And one method is to use effective field theory. Assume that you only have to deal with the dimension 6 operators, in which case there are eight parameters. Yep. Shown here. Hmm? Yep. Yeah. And then you just go through through these. There are relationships between the HZZ couplings and the HZZ couplings. And the TGCs give you information about these couplings, and then you go and then you have the electroweak precision physics, which constrains these couplings. Then you go through them, and you end up. The electroweak precision and the ILC measurements of TGCs and other measurements of TGCs reduce the number from 8 to 4, and when considering these couplings, you note that two of the parameters are determined by the usual couplings that you talked about of the Higgs to the W and the Z. And you go through, and then but then there's one parameter that's related to a Lorentz structure parameter that's been studied, and limits have been placed on that. But in the end, you combine all these measurements of TGCs, electric precision observables, the standard Higgs coupling measurements, and in the end, you end up with only one unconstrained parameter called the C6 bar. And if the best match to the major Higgs cross section is this equal to zero, then within the errors, you've observed the self-coupling. So, anyway, this is one procedure by which one can deal, using effective field theory, that one can deal with this this quartic coupling diagram, which you have no other measurement. Okay. And then on top of that, yes. And then on top of that, one can measure the Higgs cross section at two different energies, and that'll provide another. Then you get into actually directly measuring the. We're sort of concerned with what happens if you're stuck at 500 GeV for a long time. How can you deal with this? Then this was the other CVC versus ILC, the other measurements. Comparing them, and if you're comfortable combining the triple Higgs measurement of the two, then you get this error, and this just shows the top measurement and the fact that 250 GeV don't contribute to that. I have the same thing for FCCE. I don't think it's that instructive to go through it. Let's see, for example, how does ILC help FCCE? And these couplings here, what's the equivalent FCCEE running time to get the combination and of the two together? What's the extra FCCEE running time to achieve what you get with the ILC alone? And then the opposite one, what's the extra ILC running time to achieve what you get with the FCCEE alone? And for example, for gamma-gamma, for these small branching ratio decays, the circular collider really tremendous advantage of the ILC for those. Let me just summarize the ILC plus FCCE, and that'll summarize the talk. That first of all, a 0.25% measurement of sigma times branching ratio Higgs to BV bar of the W of fusion from ILC helps reduce the errors in all Higgs coupling. Of course, the direct pop Yukawa coupling measurement improves upon what can be achieved at FCCE with a threshold scan. And then the Z, as we just talked about, the Z Higgs measurement provides a 27% tree level determination of the Higgs self-coupling, and helps clarify what one sees in the Z Higgs cross-section measurement. And then FCCEE helps ILC. The precision measurement of the Z coupling and the various sigma times branching ratio measurements at 240 GeV help turn this 0.25 measurement of the sigma times branch ratio at ILC into an excellent measurement of the WW Higgs coupling. Then also you have much better measurement of the Higgs invisible with VSM decays, rare decays such as gamma gamma. And then I note that this you can actually use a constraint in a model independent way, that all the branching, all the known branching ratios equal sum up to one. If you can place a limit on all possible Beyond Standard Model decays of less than 1%, and so if you can, if you really felt, if you come up, it's not been done yet, but if you can come up with some way to cover all possible decays and set this limit here, then you stick in this constraint, and then you further reduce all the coupling errors that I've shown earlier are reduced even further in a model-independent way. And then that's just an example of, and the results, the CPC combining with the ILC are the same here, and are not too different, a little bit worse, but not too different from what's shown here. So building the two machines together would really be a really good thing. And these are the levels of the model-independent precisions that we achieve.
So when you mentioned first generation Fermi, when you mentioned first generation fermions, you're referring to the plus and minus?
The direct S channel 125 GeV center mass energy production. So that's what this, yeah.
Sorry, maybe you mentioned the number, but is there an estimation of what is the bound that you could put on the coupling of the Higgs with the Raptions?
So that's. Let me go back to that slide.
Okay.
It's kind of.
It's 95%
complex. So 95% complex level, they get within. They get 1.7 of the standard model.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's equivalent to 10 years of fronting at this point.
Yeah, and then you sacrifice. Yeah, there are a lot of things. Yeah, there are a lot of.
Yeah.
So it's 1 year. Yeah, 1 year running at 125 GV, and the beam. Yeah. There's beam spread. There's also, if you somehow get polarization, obviously if you get polarization, you could,
right.
You could help that.
What is your professional, to me this is the dubious thing, because you're FCC, you're not going to get the polarization. How do you get this, the number is amazing, right, but I don't believe you get that spread, at least. I won't ask you to comment publicly, but it seems difficult to me.
What would be a realistic number? The spread?
And then whatever it is, it's probably luminosity. There's probably an inverse relationship between the spread and the luminosity. And so it's.
I would classify this as broken process.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, I guess it's intriguing. It's intriguing. Yeah.
Any other questions or discussions?
Can you just explain again why the sort of sigma time branching ratio for the WW Higgs is so much better than doing it in Z Higgs at 250?
I'm trying
to understand why the best sigma times branching ratio is from the is the vector boson fusion at 350, and why is it better than Z Higgs at 250?
Can you show the
cross section of mass energy? Do you want to look at the couplings or the sigma times branching ratio measurement table? I have sigma times branching ratio measurement tables, and I have these coupling bar graphs.
What's the sigma times branching ratio in Z Higgs? What's the uncertainty on that one?
We'll go back a little further.
Let's go back.
That one.
So this one. Now.
So it's 1.2%, for example, in 250 inverse temperature bars at 250. But the circular machines claim to get a much larger luminosity. And yet, somehow, it's best to use the 350 GeV number. I'm trying to understand. I don't know. Why is 350 so much better that it makes up for the much larger luminosity in the circular machines at 250?
Well, now are you talking now about, first of all, of course, obviously the cross-section obviously you have a much larger cross-section for WW fusion at 350 than you have at 250.
How much bigger? compared to ZH at 250.
But ZH is... But it's a different process.
You're sort of trying to use. I thought one well-measured sigma times branching ratio together with the total cross-section measurement at 250.
But at 250, what you're combining the sigma time, you're combining this measurement at 350 or 500 GV with sigma, an important measurement that we haven't talked about. You're combining it with this measurement here, which is actually quite important. ZH followed by H to WW, and that's kind of how you're combining. Yeah, combining this measurement here with this measurement here.
Obviously.
Right.
And to get to that 0.23% you were quoting, you're not using this measurement, you're using the one at the higher luminosity circular machine or something.
Well, to get the
6.4%, that's pretty uncertain.
Yeah. Well, but bear in mind these are kind of fixed luminosities that were done for the physics studies. These are kind of lowish. These are lowest luminosities shown here, so we're always, you know, when we choose a different luminosity, we just simply scale these errors. Let me just mention one thing though. That I at first, when I heard about this, the CPC running only at 250 GV, I said to myself, man, they're going to really need some other machine to run at high energy to get the WW fusion results. But they have so much luminosity that you know, by themselves, they CPC does get very good. They get very good coupling measurements. Because they are using the WW fusion at 250 GV. I mean, even though the cross section is small, they're utilizing it to get all these couplings and this total width measurement without any, you know, the red lines here have nothing from 350 GV. This is all 250 GV, and yet they have enough luminosity that they get enough WW fusion events to get these results shown here. That surprised me the first time I realized it or saw it.
Anybody else? All right, well, let's thank Tim.